Good morning, everyone. I can't believe we only have 2 days of class left. It's so sad. All right. My hope is we'll get pretty far through the remaining puzzles today, and then tomorrow will actually end up being a fairly short class. And then you guys are done for the semester until it's time for the final. All right, so let's kind of regroup. We've now gone through three puzzles. Let's try to regroup and kind of capture some big picture ideas that will then help us do the remaining problems where things start to get a little bit more complicated. Sorry. All right. So number one, what we have to be on the watch for are substance-specific state procedures. All right, state procedural rules that operate within the judicial process, but that are specific to particular substantive areas of law and are doing so for substantive reasons. All right, which is why that first question is, which is why we can't just say we jump right to state law, because we got to figure out what state law is. And so that's why that first question is, the state law arguably procedural, excuse me, as opposed to substantive in every traditional sense, is so important. All right, but a lot of the states achieved tort reform or tried to achieve tort reform through, at least in part, put that away, please. Through at least in part procedural mechanisms. All right, so closer trial court scrutiny of jury verdicts, closer court of appeals scrutiny of jury verdicts, particularly in the medical malpractice area. So we have Med-Mal specific rules governing jury size, governing certificates of merit. You need an affidavit by an expert saying that there's some there in order to file your case. That's what's at issue in Burke. You have to go through mandatory non-binding mediation before you can file a Med-Mal case. So the question is, if all these procedures are in place in state court, do they also have to apply in federal court? Now that requires us, though, to look under the hood of arguably procedural rules, all right? For purposes of the bound up prong of Byrd, because we have to ask why this rule is in place, and also for 2072 purposes, all right? Because if state law creates a mechanism with substantive purposes in mind, does that trigger a 2072B problem? Does that trigger an abridge, enlarge, or modify problem? All right? Everybody with me? Now, there's an argument that all of this is improper, that if states truly want to do tort reform, then do tort reform by altering the substantive law. All right, you want to make it harder for doctors to be held liable, then change the liability rules for medical malpractice. Don't do it via this procedural backdoor. Number two, 1652 in a large number of cases is going to dictate the outcome. That is, the answer to the 1652 question, does the Constitution, Treaty, or Act of Congress otherwise require or provide, does an act of Congress or the Constitution answer the question, is going to determine what the resolution of the problem is. Why? Well, if we find that a rule of civil procedure answers the question, what do we know? If we find, yes, a rule of civil procedure, a rule enacted under the Rules Enabling Act answers the question, then what do we know?
That rule applies
if?
It is procedural.
No, well, yeah, because if it's procedural, is going towards what? Toward what, Logan? If it's valid. What do we know, Chloe?
They are almost always.
They're always valid. All right, so if you find that the rule applies, it's sort of predetermined. We know the rule's going to be valid unless something went really, really wrong, in which case federal law is going to apply. By contrast, if we're trying to figure out whether state law applies when there's no conflict with the Constitution, Treaty, or Act of Congress, The answer is very often going to be yes. Because if the rule is not, if the state law rather is not arguably procedural, it's substantive in every traditional sense, it applies on the command of Erie. And if we do a relatively unguided Erie choice, very, very often, or it is likely that it is going to point to state law. Particularly where we're dealing with these substantively unique procedural state procedures and these substantively motivated state procedures. All right? Because they're trying to achieve substantive aims by changing how parties litigate. And by changing how the case gets litigated, they hope to achieve some substantive purpose. So not always, and by the way, this can't be part of your analysis. Oh, relative unguided Erie choice, state law always applies, end of story. No, just for our kind of practical way of thinking about it. All right, so puzzle number two is sort of the odd example out, and it's kind of everybody's paradigm of a non-outcome determinative rule, a rule that is not going to cause anybody to pick a forum, all right, and so would not apply under the relatively unguided Erie analysis. All right, most rules aren't that. Most state law isn't that simple. In part because the twin aims tend to go in the same direction. Not always, but in a lot of cases, the twin aims are going to go in the same direction. Makes sense. If not applying state law would cause the character result to differ materially, it's probably going to, not applying state law would probably encourage forum shopping. And if both of the twin aims point towards state law, there's a really good chance that that state law is bound up with substantive policy. So now you've got three of the factors pointing in the direction of state law, and then you've got, you know, federal interest, countervailing federal interest over here. It's a balancing test. So you've got three points that are pushing one way and one pushing the other. You kind of get a sense of how it's going to come out. Now, if we go back to puzzle three, I didn't tell you what the right answer is because finding the right answer is less important than just making sure that you do the analysis. I can tell you that the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, where this problem arises from, applies the state law 12-person juror in Med-Mal cases. All right, everybody with me? When might it go the other way? All right, two things to look for. One, do the twin aims point in different directions? Sometimes they will. All right, sometimes yes, not applying state law will cause the character result to differ materially, but not in a way that will induce forum shopping. All right, not in a way that's going to affect anybody's choice of forum. And there may be cases in which the countervailing federal interest is uniquely high, all right? It is uniquely about something that is fundamental to the federal judicial process, and therefore is going to carry more weight in the balance, all right? So for example, New York's tort reform was to get closer judicial review of jury verdicts. So a state court could review and either overturn or reduce a jury verdict as excessive if the court found that it was unreasonably high. And that the trial court made that finding. And that determination was subject to de novo review on appeal. All right. By contrast, the federal common law practice was to be highly deferential to the jury verdict, to only overturn or reduce the verdict if it was so excessive as to be conscience shocking, right? And that determination was reviewed for abuse of discretion. So highly deferential appellate review. And what the court said on the relatively unguided Erie analysis is the federal common law is going to control because that sort of deferential appellate review was so fundamental to the way the federal judiciary was organized. That's what you're looking for, a uniquely strong countervailing federal interest. Third, and so now we can go back. Is, you know, spending less money on juries, is that a uniquely powerful, Emily, is, you think that's a uniquely powerful countervailing federal interest?
No.
We don't have to pay jurors quite as much?
No.
No, probably not. And that's why the Eastern District came out the way it did. Number three, the question is, does the act of Congress answer the question? And so now here we have to get really precise about what the act of Congress says and what the precise question is. All right, and we need precision in both of those. Because another way that courts have framed this is to ask whether the act of Congress is sufficiently broad to control the issue. Is it sufficiently broad to control the issue? So now, again, that precision. What is it that the state law, or that the federal law, excuse me, that the act of Congress says and means? All right, and what is the precise issue? All right. So it may be that the act of Congress sort of speaks to the general area, but it doesn't control the precise issue before the court. It doesn't answer the precise question that is presented to the court. All right, and so back to, yeah.
So wouldn't that be a sufficiently specific
to control? What's that? Well, they talk about the breadth because it's the specificity is going to the breadth of how broad or narrow the federal law is.
Okay.
So, I mean, yeah, if you get on the bench, you want to use a different term, you can. But right now they've talked about the breadth of the law. So, again, back to puzzle number three. That's what's going on. All right. Rule 48 gives us a range, but it doesn't tell us how many jurors to put in the box. And so now the question is, well, or now we have to figure out, okay, what is the precise question that we have to answer? Because if the question was, what are the possible numbers of jurors? Does Rule 48 control that? Why?
Because it gives you a range.
Okay, yeah, it gives us a range. And so the question is, can we seat 25 jurors? Rule 48 answers that. The answer is no. But if we're trying to figure out how many jurors to put in the box, Rule 48 doesn't speak to that. For another example, look at Rule 65. So the power of courts to issue injunctions and restraining orders. So Rule 65 authorizes courts to grant injunctions. A1, the court may issue a preliminary injunction. Lays out the procedure that parties must follow to obtain a preliminary injunction. If we look at 65D, it tells us the contents of the injunction, such as 65D2, who may be bound by the injunction. But it doesn't tell us the legal standard for whether or not to grant that injunction. It doesn't tell us what the plaintiff has to show in order to get that injunction. That's coming from someplace else. Where's it coming from? What's that? But created by who? Well, no, if we're in federal court. It's judge-made federal law. It's equity. All right? So now, again, what's the question? If the question is who can be bound by this injunction, yeah, 65D2 answers that question. All right? If the question is, you know, does the court have to give notice before issuing injunction, yeah, 65A answers that question. But if the question is, what is the legal standard for that injunction, 65 does not address that. All right. Everybody with me? All right, that legal rule, that standard, is coming from someplace else. All right. What next? We have to figure out whether a particular act of Congress, or the question is going to involve in asking whether an act of Congress otherwise requires or provides, does it answer the question, we may have to get a little bit particular. Is there a particular act of Congress? Is there a particular rule? And does it answer the question? Now, one thing we might encounter is, well, in order to figure out whether this act of Congress answers the question, what do we have to do with this act of Congress? What's necessary? We're looking to figure out whether an act of Congress answers the question. What might that require us to do with respect to the act of Congress?
Test its validity.
What's that?
Exactly.
Before that. Because we only test its validity if 1652 suggests that it controls, right? So what's before that?
Analyze the statute.
What do you mean by analyze? Give me a word other than analyze.
Look at the language, policy, history.
To figure out what?
To figure out what Congress is trying to do when they pass.
Okay, in other words, what do we have to do? Analyze is the wrong word. Jesus?
Test the statute.
No? Yeah. And what do we have to do? Mackenzie?
Interpret.
We have to interpret it. All right, it may require an act of interpretation to figure out the answer to the 1652 question. All right, so there's two underlying issues there. How do we interpret it? We'll come back to that tomorrow. All right, and what qualifies as interpretation? What qualifies as interpretation of the text of a statute or a rule enacted under the REA? Put a pin in that. We'll come back to it. All right. Kind of related issue. What if there's no one particular act of Congress or no one particular rule that answers the question? Now, there's two things we could say about that. All right. One is, well, actually, you know what? Let's get into puzzle number four, and then we'll figure out the question here. All right. But that leads to another way that that courts sometimes reframe the issue. And Justice Jackson talks about this in her concurring opinion in Burke. Is there a direct collision between the act of Congress, including the rules enacted under the REA, and state law? Or is it possible that they could coexist? All right, puzzle number four. So the state has the anti-SLAPP law, which is designed to limit or eliminate lawsuits that are filed primarily for the purpose of deterring people from participating in public debate, and it's designed to protect public debate, protect First Amendment interests. All right, the defendant, how does the defendant tee all this up in federal court? Plaintiff files this lawsuit, files a defamation action. The defendant thinks it is without merit and primarily filed because the defendant exercised his First Amendment rights. So the defendant, what do you do to tee this up? What do you do to tee this up, Ahana? Okay, they file, and that special and expedited motion comes from where? Okay, it comes from state law. And so implicitly, the defendant, by making that motion, is arguing what?
That state law.
Okay, what's the plaintiff going to do in response to the special and expedited motion? Yeah.
File a response.
And the response is going to argue what?
That the excess special motion should be denied.
Because? Well, no. You're getting too precise. Let's keep it a little more general for right now. The opposition is what? Yeah.
The motion to deny because
the claim has merit. Nope. Okay, because state law doesn't apply. So what's not available in federal court? Okay, yeah, that motion is not available in state court. We're not getting into the merits of this. Obviously, they're going to try to argue that they survived the motion. But the first argument is, no, I shouldn't even have to, you can't grant this motion, court, because state law does not apply. All right, plaintiff, where do you start your analysis?
State law.
Second. All right, and is there an act of Congress that answers the question? The entire body of all 80-plus rules of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure? That's a lot.
Well, I think multiple rules apply.
Tell me.
Rule 8A sets up the standard for pleading.
Yeah, but this isn't a pleading.
And Rule 12?
No, you can get a little more specific than that. Which part of Rule 12? Which part of Rule 12B? Okay, what is it that Rule 12b-6 does? Based on what? And that motion is based on what? Yeah, and so what is the 12b-6 arguing? Because, and we make that determination by looking at what? No, not by looking at Rule 8. Four corners of the pleading, and what's required? What is required to for a pleading to survive a 12b-6? And what's required for them to state a claim? Yeah. Okay.
Stating the facts that support a plausible.
And what must be? Go. Okay, it's got to be plausible. There's one rule. All right, a 12b-6, which looks at the four corners of the complaint and requires that the pleading be plausible, or that the claim on the facts, smartass, be plausible. Is there another rule that might apply? Yeah.
Summary judgment 56.
Why? What does that do? Right, but right. So, what is it that Rule 56 does?
It can dismiss the claim.
Doesn't dismiss. It grants summary judgment.
It can grant summary judgment.
When?
At any point after.
When? On what basis?
Lack of merit.
That's not what Rule 56 says. So when, Angel?
When there's a lack of a genuine dispute of a material fact.
Okay, and?
When a reasonable trier of fact can find for the.
Can?
Or must find for the, not the language, so.
Now that's a problem. Yeah.
Find
otherwise besides what?
Like the movement is entitled to judgment.
Who is entitled?
The movement.
Okay.
Is entitled to judgment.
Because the trier of fact, reasonable trier of fact, couldn't find for who?
Couldn't find for the non-moving.
Okay, exactly. All right, yeah. There's no genuine dispute, and no reasonable jury could find for the... for the non-movement. All right. So we've got two rules there. Of course, neither of them looks at both evidence in the pleading, which the special motion does, and neither of them looks at whether the lawsuit is without merit and filed for an improper or filed primarily. For an improper purpose. One looks at whether the claim is plausible on the allegations in the four corners of the complaint. The other, Ahana, looks at what?
Look.
Summary judgment looks at what?
Discovery.
Okay, looks at all the evidence uncovered in discovery to ask whether there's a genuine dispute. All right, neither of those is what's in the special motion, right? So what's the plaintiff's argument for why federal law controls? What's the argument? What's the argument? Because we've got two rules, not one. So what's the argument for why there is a constitution that other, there is a, excuse me, an act of Congress that otherwise requires or provides? Angel? But you can look at 2072. What do you have to do before you can look at 2072? You've got to look at 1652, right? So we're still looking at 1652. We're still trying to figure out whether these rules, these two rules that you've just identified, answer the question. whether they control the issue. Yeah.
Because Section 1652, taken in conjunction with the Supremacy Clause.
But only if the act of Congress controls, or excuse me, only if the act of Congress answers the question. You're skipping ahead. So 1652 requires, one, does the act of Congress answer the question? If it does, then yes, it has to control, because the Supremacy Clause in 1652 say it does, provided it is valid. That's what takes us to 2072. But you're skipping the first question, which is, does an act of Congress answer the question? Now, the plaintiff is saying, yeah, because we got 12b6 and we got summary judgment. And my question is, how do those answer this question? Given that, one, it's two different rules, and two, they are using different language than what's in state law. And so what's the answer to that, Yusuf?
12b?
No. What do you mean by that? And how are they, and how do they both answer the question? Merits based on what? Okay. And summary judgment? It's not a dismissal. Matters outside the pleadings, and together, what do they do?
Determine
how to do what? Determine how to do what, or control how to do what? Don't say dismiss, because that's not right.
Allow the plaintiff to file for a judgment based off the...
But the plaintiff isn't filing.
Well, it would allow for a judgment based off the merits and matters outside of the pleadings.
Without, well, right, but 12b6 wouldn't do that. So again, to get now I'm trying to think of them together. You tell me.
Establishing procedure.
To do what?
To establish judgment as a matter.
Without what?
Without fact finder.
No. Well, yeah, without fact finder. So without what?
Without substantive law.
No.
Oh, sorry about that. My bad.
I don't know how you granted 12, how you decided 12b6 without substantive law. Then you're just dancing around.
Without trial.
They together are mechanisms for resolving cases prior to trial, or resolving cases without trial. Then 12b6 looking only at what? And Ahana 56 looking at what? Namely? Okay, the evidence in discovery. But the argument is what? Together, what do they do?
They answer the question.
Which is what? The question of how to do what? No. How to do what? Yeah.
Test claims before trial.
Do what to claims?
Test.
Okay, yeah, how to test or get right. Yeah, or how to resolve. Yeah, test works too. Yeah, how to test and how to resolve claims without trial. All right, so what if there's no one rule that applies? Maybe there's multiple rules that apply. And now the question is, do we have to look at these rules as an integrated whole? That together, they provide the process for pretrial merits resolution of the case. Now, if the plaintiff's right about that, Angel, now what?
We go to Section 2072.
Okay, which part?
272A.
Okay. Is this, does this really regulate procedure?
Yes.
Why? By this, I mean, do rules 12 and 56 together really regulate procedure? Why?
Because it is regulating the judicial process for...
Why? You can't just repeat the standard. Okay, yeah, why does it, why, so yeah, you've got to mention the judicial process because that's your definition of procedure. So if you're going to say it really regulates procedure, you got to define that term. Okay, now you've defined your term. Beautiful. That's your rule explanation. What's your application? Why are these two rules together arguably procedural?
Because they're governing the actions of the parties as they go through the litigation. litigation process.
Okay, and particularly how to do what?
How to litigate. I don't know if that's too vague.
Let's get a little more specific. What do you mean by how to litigate?
How to best serve their own interests.
They govern how claims are disposed before trial.
How to resolve claims? What else do motions do?
Expedite the...
No, but what do you do with a motion? I mean, what's the point of a motion?
For defense.
But anybody can make a motion, right? What do motions do within the litigation process? When do you need to make a motion? Yeah. Okay, yeah. And so is the filing of... And in this case, we're asking the court to do what? Or... Okay, yeah, grant summary judgment. We're asking the court to resolve the case without trial. All right? All this is happening within the litigation process. This is how we adjudicate things, how we act, how we raise issues for the court within the litigation process. What's the point of pretrial disposition? What's the point of these mechanisms for either one of these mechanisms for pretrial disposition? What's the point? Kristen? Okay, because why, and why do we want to do that? What do you mean? Okay, so it's more efficient? We save time and money, it's faster. How does that tie into our definition of procedure? Lucas? Yeah, different definition. Yeah.
Regulates the manners and means.
Nope, wrong definition. Yeah. Yeah, making it faster, making it cheaper, making it more efficient. There's your just administration, right? Are we making the process fairer and more efficient? All right, Angel, what's next? After 2072A, if you're right that it is arguably procedural, that it really regulates procedure, what's next?
Next is 2072B.
Which asks?
Whether such rules abridge, enlarge, modify any of the substantive rights.
Okay, because what does 72B tell us?
It tells us that Congress
can... No, what does 2072B tell us? The words Congress do not appear anywhere in 2072B.
That the rules can't take away...
Thank you. Yeah, all three of them. Can abridge, enlarge, or modify any substantive rights? Now, to answer this question, what are we going to have to do? Yeah.
Identify if there are any substantive rights.
Underlying what?
Underlying the federal rules.
No. Underlying what? Yeah. Nope.
The state statute
that we're going to apply. Oh, that we're going to apply federal law over. So, do they? Are there substantive interests that underlie this state statute?
Yes.
Why?
Protecting First Amendment rights.
Okay. And protect. What else is it protecting? Or protecting First Amendment's rights where?
Free speech.
Okay. Thank you.
All in public.
Okay. Yeah. Out there in the real world. Those are substantive concerns. So is there an abridge and enlarge, is there a 2072B problem then? Why not?
Because the relationship between these rules and the infringement on the substantive right is merely incidental.
Okay, yeah, there's where Burlington and incidental comes into play. This is the incidental effect. That Congress did not, that was unavoidable, and that Congress did not mean to deem a violation of 2072B. Right. Everybody see that? What's the defendant's argument? So now if you're the defendant, arguing that the anti-SLAPP statute should apply, what's your argument? How do you make that argument? Yeah.
That neither rule solely answers the question.
Why not?
Because either rule addresses a motion to dismiss with just affidavits.
Okay. So what can we say about the two federal rules? They don't answer the question. How's another, what's another way we can think of it? Yeah.
They're not broad enough.
Okay. All right. Okay, so the federal rules do their thing and what's possible. What does that leave room for? Okay, that state law can coexist. All right. Rule 12 regulates one area, challenge to the complaint itself, to the four corners of the complaint. Summary judgment regulates another area, and now state law is just kind of filling in the gaps. There is room for state law to operate. In other words, there is no direct collision, or the rules can coexist. Rule 12 can do its thing, Rule 56 can do its thing, and there's still room for state law to operate. It's filling in the gaps in the federal rules of civil procedure. All right? It's filling in the areas that are not directly covered by the combination of a motion to dismiss and a motion for summary judgment. It's doing something different. It's getting rid of the case based on both the complaints and the affidavits, all right, in one particular small class of cases. So it's this unique thing, this unique motion for this unique category of case, all right? If that's right, okay, so they can coexist. There is no direct collision. Federal law is not sufficiently broad to control, not sufficiently broad to answer the question. If you like, not specifically specific, other than being redundant, but or sufficiently specific, that works too, because the rules can coexist. Now, if that's right for the defendant, where do we go? Where does the defendant's analysis then go? Where does the defendant's analysis go? Veronica? Well, there's something we got to ask first. Is it? Why? You got to do better than that. Okay, yeah, it's a motion. So it's by definition, it's governing in litigation. Okay, so now what do we do? Now what do we do? What do we call this? Okay, what are we choosing between? And what? Yeah. Does federal law talk about this at all? No. If you're right that the state law is just filling in these gaps between Rule 12 and Rule 56, then yeah, it's federal silence. All right. Okay. Do your relatively unguided eerie analysis. What's the first thing? Okay, let's bracket forum shopping for a second. Let's do the other aim first.
Okay, so would it lead to
Okay, so would not applying the state law cause what do what? Or what else could be materially different besides the result? Yeah. The character, okay, the way the litigation proceeds. Okay. Defense, what's your argument? Why?
Because it's expedited in state court, so I'm
going to
be able to do it quicker, and I don't have to endure the process of discovery and a summary judgment.
Okay, that's true. So you don't have to, so it's
going to
get it out quicker.
I'm going to save money.
Okay, so no discovery, so it's going to be coster, it's going to be faster, cheaper. Is it going to produce a result that would be different than a 12B6?
No.
Are you sure about that? Okay. For the defendant, make the argument that it's going to produce something, that it may produce a different result than either a Rule 12 or a Rule 56 motion. No. I mean, yeah, it probably would be with prejudice,
right.
So what's possible with a complaint that is filed that is ultimately non-meritorious and filed for an improper primary purpose? No. We've got this complaint, all right? And from the looks of it, when we start to look at affidavits, boy, it looks like it's without merit. And it's filed for an improper purpose. But what could nevertheless happen with that complaint?
New evidence comes.
No, forget about new evidence, because you can't look at new evidence on a 12b6.
It could limit the defendant.
No.
It could survive a 12b6.
Why?
Because the 12b6 only looks at the complaint.
And only asks what about that complaint?
If it states a claim for relief.
What about that complaint? That claim?
If that claim for relief
is Veronica is plausible. Could you have something that ultimately is not meritorious and filed for an improper purpose that is nevertheless plausible? Sam's nodding his head yes. Why, Sam?
Because Rule 8.
I don't know what that means.
You need to get a short plain statement for your grounds of relief.
So. Well, no, but it's got to be plausible. But if we, okay, so if the affidavits show us that there's no merit, could it have,
it could still,
based on what? Looking only at what?
Looking only at Rule 8.
No, looking only at what? Looking only at the complaint. We could envision a complaint that is plausible, even though when we sort of dig into it, it turns out to be nonsense. We certainly could imagine a complaint that could be plausible, even if it's filed for an improper purpose, for a primary purpose of trying to chill somebody's speech. So there's your distinction. There's why the result might differ materially. Because if federal law controls, this is just going to be a 12b6, it might survive a 12b6, where it's not going to survive the special motion. Veronica, is it possible that a claim that couldn't survive a special motion might survive summary judgment? Why?
Because
they can introduce new evidence. Okay. Right. But what is the court looking for? When will the court deny summary judgment? Okay. All right. Yeah, go ahead.
They might not.
We don't know what the affidavits look like. So again, it may be that there would be a genuine dispute that would preclude summary judgment, that nevertheless, the case would still fail under the special motion. So there's where the result might differ materially. All right, because this case could survive one of the motions in federal court where it wouldn't survive in state court. All right, and then what's next? What do you mean? Is going to prompt forum shopping by who to where?
It's going to cause the plaintiff to forum shop in the federal court because they won't apply the state law.
Okay, yeah, because they're going to federal court to avoid state law. I don't want to have to deal with this motion. I just want to deal with Twombly because I can probably plead a plausible claim. I can show a genuine dispute now and maybe I can get further in the litigation. All right, what's next? All right, what's the first prong? Is it?
Yeah.
Why?
I would say so.
I'm glad you would say so. I just want an answer.
Because they're doing to discourage meritless claims.
In order to do what? Just save money so the court doesn't have to deal with meritless claims? Okay, those don't sound like they have anything to do with substantive social policy.
Oh, to protect free speech.
Okay, by doing what?
By making it harder to bring a claim for public.
Well, it's pretty easy to bring that. I mean, all you have to do is file the complaint. It's pretty easy to bring the claim. So how does the SLAPP law protect those First Amendment interests? How does it protect those First Amendment interests?
It makes it easier for the defendant to dismiss the case.
Okay, to get rid of the case earlier. And if I can get rid of it earlier...
Are you looking at me
Yeah. What's the benefit of getting rid of it earlier?
I save money.
Okay, and how does that support substantive interests, substantive First Amendment interests?
Defendants can go about their life without worrying about being sued for...
Or they know if they are sued...
That it'll go away.
That it'll go away quickly. All right, exactly. All right. We're not going to chill participation in public debate through the threat of litigation. All right, where the process is the punishment. All right, if I know I could be sued, if I know I'm going to have to bear the cost of litigation, all right, I'm not going to exercise my First Amendment rights. The slap law comes along and says, yeah, if you do get sued, you're going to get out of it more quickly. What's last? What's the last part? Is there? No, because what do we have on the other side of state law? In this case? No. We've got federal silence. There's nothing there. All right. Everybody see that? So we've got two different ways of doing this. And again, 1652 telling you whether you're doing an REA analysis or whether you're doing a relatively unguided Erie choice is pretty much dictating the outcome. We've got a circuit split on this, and the split reflects the analytical divide that we just described. All right? The Ninth Circuit and the First Circuit in Godin, in fact, adopted Veronica's approach, that the federal rules don't rule 56 and rule 12 aren't sufficiently broad. There's room for the slap motion to operate, and so it applies in state court. Every other circuit to address the issue, including the D.C. Circuit, in an opinion by then-Judge Kavanaugh, said Rule 12 and Rule 56 are an integrated whole for pretrial resolution of claims. And so the federal rule controls. We'll talk about this more tomorrow. It appears that Burke would support the federal rule, the majority position that the federal rules control. That the act of Congress controls. Number five, there's a different provision. So let's say that the special motion doesn't apply in federal court. There's a separate provision of the anti-slap law that allows the defendant, if he prevails, to recover attorney's fees. Right. So how would this come up? So the court dismisses, or the court grants a 12b6. Now how does this come up? How would this come up? Yeah. Okay, defendant moves for attorney's fees, and implicit in that motion, the defendant's arguing what? All right, and what's the plaintiff going to, Finley, what's the plaintiff going to do in response?
The plaintiff doesn't argue about federal law.
Or at least that state law doesn't apply. Okay. Finley, for the plaintiff. For the defendant, where do you start your analysis? All right. Is there an act of Congress that otherwise requires or provides? Have we seen any rule of procedure or statute that deals with attorney's fees? Now, what is the usual rule in federal court for with respect to attorney's fees?
Everyone pays for their
own. Okay. Where does that come from?
Judge-made federal law.
Okay. Yeah, that's common law. That's procedural common law. The American rule. All right. So no act of Congress controls. So what's next? Is it?
Yes.
Why? Remember, arguably procedural is just, is there a rational argument that it is procedural? The fact that you say yes doesn't mean what about that law?
Doesn't mean purely procedural.
It could also be what?
Partially.
And then, therefore, partially.
That's
Yeah. The fact that you're saying it's arguably procedural or rationally capable of, remember what Hannah said, rationally capable of classification as either. So to say it's rationally, it's arguably procedural doesn't mean it is not substantive. It may still be substantive as well. But it just means that it at least is in part procedural. Is it arguably procedural? True, that's not responsive to the arguably procedural question. I mean, is that procedural as you're just describing it?
No. I mean, a little bit, but mostly.
That's a little bit. Why is it a little bit?
Well, because it protects, it has to do with the litigation.
Has to do with the litigation? What else does it have to do with? Yeah.
It has to do with
No, but that's circular because that's assuming that state law applies. This is what we're still trying to figure out. Chloe?
The judicial process?
How so?
Because it applies how it governs how the court applies the law?
No, I mean, that's true of everything.
Whether justice is justly administered because
we hope justice is justly administered. It would be sad if it wasn't. We'll come back to that. Yeah, okay. So that might work. It may be a docket control mechanism.
But the judicial process is how the parties interact with one another in terms of who pays what.
Yeah. All right. It's how litigation is going to get funded. It's part of what the judge is going to issue at the end of the litigation. All right. It's part of how the litigation is going to end. That certainly seems procedural. I think, you know, how litigation gets funding. No less procedural than the state law requiring disclosure of third-party funding agreements. All right. So it's arguably procedural. Now what? Someone other than Finley and Veronica, they've been carrying you all for 50 minutes now. It's time for somebody else to do some actual work here. Hey, Seuss?
We asked a relatively young guy to give you choice.
And what are we choosing between?
The American law and
which is what? Which comes from where?
Judge made common law.
Okay, common law against what?
Against state law.
Okay, so it's state law against federal procedural common law. What's the first step in the relatively unguided Erie?
We look at York and then we ask whether avoid inequitable administration.
And so what are we asking?
Whether not applying the state law in federal court as would substantially affect the result.
I guess it's not exactly, but and what else?
And or whether same first question, would the character or result differ?
Okay, that's the same thing. And what else?
And forum shopping.
What about forum shopping?
Whether not administering the state law in the same way that
or just not applying state law?
Not applying state law would encourage forum shopping.
Okay, by who to where?
By the plaintiff to federal court.
Okay, let's take that one first. Would not applying the fee shifting in federal court encourage forum shopping?
Yes.
Why?
Because in order to avoid paying attorney's fees should they lose the litigation, they would go to federal court.
Okay, yeah. Forum shopping is pretty clear there. Yeah, I'm running to federal court to get away from the risk of paying attorney's fees. How about character or result? Now, the result of the litigation isn't going to vary if the federal court doesn't grant fees, right? Because who wins or loses has nothing to do with whether fees are granted, right? So what's your argument as the defendant trying to argue that state law controls? What's the argument that...
Well,
not applying state law would cause the character result to differ materially.
Well, the result would alter because then that would require the plaintiff to pay more than at the end.
Well, no. But the result of the case is who wins or who loses the case. And that's not affected by whether or not the plaintiff then has to, if the plaintiff loses, she has to pay attorney's fees, right? That's not going to affect the outcome of the case. Who wins and who loses, is it? Okay, so what is the argument that not applying state law would undermine this eerie aim? Lauren? Do you know a lot of lawyers who take cases that are... Oh, I see. Yeah, it's a little different than contingency fees. Was that taking a shot at plaintiff's lawyers who work on contingency?
Like, yeah.
Okay. Like, yeah? Yeah. It's a little bit different. I see your point. It's a little bit different. Because remember, the fees here are potentially going to who? Who's potentially recovering fees here, Bruno?
Sorry, that was not the question.
The defendant.
The defendant's lawyer. So we're dealing with different lawyers. Ahana?
I would say that it would.
I know you would say lots of things.
It would change the character.
Why?
Because the attorneys might be more aggressive in the manner that they litigate.
Oh, I don't think it's going to make a difference. We're going to be aggressive. I'm going to zealously represent the interests of my clients. I don't think that's going to change anything.
Or maybe they want to settle earlier to not accumulate so many costs through the litigation. So it would change the result because I would want to end it earlier.
Oh, that's not really changing the result, but it is changing what?
The character.
Yeah. Okay, so maybe the case resolves earlier. That's possible. Jacob? I don't think so. Who's paying those? Let's do it this way. Who's paying those fees? If the plaintiff loses, who's paying the fees, Jose?
The plaintiff.
Plaintiff's paying the fees, not who? Who's not paying the fees? Yeah.
Defendant?
Well, yeah, who else isn't paying the fees? The plaintiff's lawyer isn't paying the fees. All right, so how might the fact that the plaintiff is going to have to pay these fees affect the character of the litigation? I'm looking right at you. You don't have to raise your hand.
It might affect the character of the litigation.
Why?
Because they might not even file in the first place if knowing that they lose, that they would have to pay the defendant's attorney's fees.
Okay. Maybe it deters plaintiffs from filing the litigation at all. From the defendant's standpoint, and maybe this is kind of getting at a Hannah settlement point, what do I know as the defendant? I get sued.
If the plaintiff loses, they have to pay those fees, so they're inclined to not get to that point.
Who's they, and what point are you talking about?
The plaintiff is inclined not to.
Okay, but look at it from the defendant's standpoint. That's what I'm trying to get at, Emily.
The defendant will settle right away as soon as the litigation.
Maybe. Why? Oh, to avoid paying the plaintiff? Well, no, but to avoid paying the... Well, but it's not a two-way shift. The plaintiff pays the defendant's fees if the complaint is found to be non-meritorious. It doesn't run the other way. So the defendant is never going to be on the hook for fees.
It would incentivize the defendant to hire the most expensive attorney possible.
Let's get off of it. You're equating money with the quality of the lawyer, and let's stop that. But what's the incentive on the defendant? Forget about who they hire.
Even in state court?
No. Why? Okay. Now, I'm not going to do it to recover the attorney's fees, but what do I know? Okay, I know that I'm not going to have to pay if this case in fact was filed for an improper person. So we're easing the burden on the defendant, right? We're easing the litigation burden on the defendant and maybe chilling or deterring the plaintiff. That affects the character. Whether the litigation is going to happen at all is certainly the character of the litigation. All right? What's next? All right, and this is why, again, character or result, substantial variance in outcome. Want to get really precise. All right, and then talking about the facts. All right, what's next, Jesus?
The bird analysis.
All right, what's the first step there?
At first, you look at the state's interest in the substantive policy.
What are you asking?
Whether the state law is bound up to the substantive policy.
Is it?
Yes.
Why?
Their interest is in protecting the First Amendment rights within the state.
How, and how is it going about doing that? Okay. And if they're filed?
And if they're filed, then the plaintiff is the one that needs to end up paying. Yes, they are.
And from the defendant's standpoint?
From
the one whose speech we're trying to protect?
From the defendant's standpoint, then the defendant is protected, more protected throughout the litigation. Because
and therefore what?
And therefore their freedom of speech is more protected.
Why?
Because I can't find the word. They're not going to suffer any harm.
They're not going to suffer any harm, and so? What are they more likely to do?
Speak up.
Yeah, they're more likely to engage in public debate because they know if they get sued and it's a crap lawsuit, they don't have to pay. What's the next step in Byrd? I mean, we've gone through 4.5 problems of this, so everybody's hand should be up here. Yeah.
The countervailing federal interest.
Countervailing federal interest in what?
In making each person pay their own attorney's fees.
Okay. What are the countervailing federal interests? What do you suppose is the policy behind the American rule?
To encourage litigation and to protect, to... Well,
what do you mean by encourage litigation? Do we like people going to court? Okay, gives everybody access to justice. How?
By ensuring that you, no matter whether they win or lose, they don't have to pay the other party's fees.
Okay, because, and who are, and in particular, who are we protecting here?
Plaintiffs.
Okay, in order for them to be able to do what?
To bring suits.
Okay, yeah. We don't want to, the whole idea of the American rule is we don't want to over-deter litigation. All right, we want plaintiffs who think they've been wrong, who have a good faith basis to believe they have a meritorious claim, to bring that claim and not be deterred by the risk of having to pay in addition to not winning the case. Everybody with me? Who thinks federal law applies? Why?
Underlying the American rule would also apply to this specific situation.
I don't know what that means.
The state law seeks to protect free speech.
Then the American rule doesn't do that because the American rule doesn't protect defendants from non-meritorious suits. And so therefore the chilling effect remains.
The American policy of
Well, no, but if the suit is non-meritorious, under state law, I get fees, and therefore I know I'm free to speak because I know I'm going to get fees. And if the American rule applies, I know that even if I win, I'm still out the money that it costs to hire the kick-ass attorney that graduated from FIU that Daniel wants to hire. And so the procedure is its own punishment because it's going to cost me something to litigate.
But the American policy it seeks to remove that punishment from all...
No, but it doesn't. That's just it. The whole idea of the American rule is if you get sued on a bullshit defamation case, you are going to be responsible for your own fees. Now, might that chill you in wanting to speak out? Yeah, that's what the state law is designed to avoid. Or Twin Aims of Erie, as we like to call them.
The Twin Aims of Erie under the York analysis and the first prong of Byrd is all leaning towards the state's substantive policy being greater than protecting equality of burden for the attorney's fees.
What would be the argument, what would be the countervailing, what would be the counter argument to that?
The countervailing federal interest in fair procedure is strong.
And more specifically, what?
Allowing a plaintiff to bring a suit?
Yeah, okay. Without having to fear what?
Without having to fear punishment.
More specifically?
Paying the attorney.
Okay, what about that? What about that countervailing federal interest?
That would outweigh, because it's one of the situations where a countervailing federal interest is strong enough that it will outweigh.
Okay. All right, so this is going to require an argument of just how important is the interest underlying the American rule. Is it equivalent to highly deferential appellate review? That's what you're going to have to argue. All right, that pay your own way is so fundamental to the American system of justice. All right, now, if this doesn't point towards state law, maybe that helps a little bit. Because, the result isn't going to differ. All right? That's how the argument has to be. Because otherwise, these three, as they so often do, all point in the direction of state law. All right? So unless you have a uniquely powerful countervailing federal interest, state law is going to apply. Again, that's how lots and lots of cases come out under the relatively unguided Erie analysis. Veronica?
Here you could just argue both.
You can always argue both.
Did the federal interest outweigh the state interest? I think it doesn't, but does it?
Number six. So state law creates a cause of action. All right. To the defendant in the slap suit. All right. So, A sues X, this is a slap. Once this is dismissed, X can now sue A under the statute. All right, so A's lawsuit against X is dismissed on a 12b6. All right, now X turns around and sues A on the statute, under the anti-slap statute. Arguing that this lawsuit was without merit and filed for an improper primary purpose. All right, defendant, what's your response to this complaint? What's your response to this complaint, Lucas? I mean, procedurally, what's your response? Well, that's a good start.
That state law doesn't apply.
Well, right, but you're just getting up and. You're just standing up on a table and saying that? You're a lawyer litigating litigation in a litigation forum. So what are you going to do? Chloe?
Move to dismiss under 12b6.
And what's your argument?
Because there is no... The state law doesn't apply, so there's no substance.
More specific, what doesn't apply?
No claim for relief.
No, what doesn't apply? Because what did we just decide what doesn't apply? Okay, yeah, we've already determined that the Florida statute doesn't apply. Rule 12 and Rule 56 do. That's the majority position, right? All right, including in the 11th Circuit. What's in the 11th Circuit? Florida's in the 11th Circuit. So the 11th Circuit had already said that a slap statute doesn't apply in federal court, and therefore dismiss X's claim. Okay, so now, Chloe, where do you start your analysis? Oh, yeah, sure. Why not? Actually, everybody's going to start the analysis in the same place. Which is what? Okay, that's a good place to start. Is there an act of Congress that answers the question about this claim?
Yes.
Is there?
In the 11th Circuit.
You filed a 12, but well, remember, the defendant filed a 12B6 to dismiss this claim that the prior lawsuit was a slap. Okay? Is there any act of Congress that deals with that?
No.
No. Everybody see the difference? It's not, oh, well, you know, they made a motion. Well, we got motions under the Federal Rules. We got lots of motions under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. We got 12B6, we got 56, we got all these lovely motions. We have the best motions. But that's not what's going on here, right, Chloe? What's going on here? Who's the, well, sorry, who's the they?
Here the defendant is trying to dismiss a claim under the Florida statute.
Okay, exactly. The defendant A is trying to dismiss this claim for failure to state a claim. All right? So, act of Congress answer the question, Chloe?
No.
So now what? Is it?
Yes. No. Actually.
Make up your mind.
I would say.
And by the way, all state law? What is it that we have to ask is arguably procedural?
The Florida law.
Which part?
The statute.
That does what? Okay, the statute that creates the cause of action, is that arguably procedural?
Yes.
Anybody disagree? Valentina?
No, I think it's purely substantive.
Give me a phrase other than purely substantive. Why? Okay, it's acting as the liability rule. All right, it's now acting as the liability rule, the rule that is substantive in every traditional sense. The state law shifted. Rather than providing a motion that you could make in litigation, now it's providing a legal right, all right, and a legal cause of action. You can recover damages from A because A filed this non-meritorious lawsuit for an improper purpose. That's the liability rule. This is like, have we seen claims either in torts or here, have we seen claims where one party can claim that somebody else's lawsuit is tortious? Yeah. No, that's something completely different. What have we seen? Yeah.
Contribution or?
No.
I don't know the exact name of it, but it was the clear code hypo, the clear code from Glennon.
Yeah.
And
was there?
Yeah. That they filed the suit because the litigation was so tortious.
Yeah, what do we call that? No. No. It's called abuse of process. Or malicious prosecution, which you might have done in torts. That this was tortious. And so now I'm recovered. Now I'm entitled to recover damages. So, Chloe, because this is not arguably procedural, that means what? It is what? Valentina, it's what? And therefore?
Therefore, it would be under the command of Erie.
What's under the command of Erie?
The state law would apply.
Okay, and so what happens to that 12B6?
It would get denied.
Okay, exactly. All right, now the law is not acting in any, the state law is not acting procedural in any way at all. All right, it is acting purely substantively. Substantive in every traditional sense. Buddy with me? Yeah.
I'm just curious, wouldn't this, well, I'm assuming since it's state law, but wouldn't it still apply like claim preclusion?
Maybe. Maybe, that doesn't mean he can't win. I mean, that just makes life easy for A, because he can invoke the claim preclusive effect of this on this. Yeah, maybe. Okay. Here's where it gets tricky. There are a lot of mixed rules. There are a lot of rules that are kind of procedural and kind of substantive. They function procedurally, but they have substantive purposes. Or they have substantive purposes and procedural purposes. Right? And the sort of paradigm of that, the one that everybody points to, is statutes of limitations. Right? Why do statutes function procedurally? Why would we say they function procedurally? Okay, they determine what about litigation?
When claims.
Yeah, when claims are going to be brought. All right? When parties have to pursue litigation. All right? So they operate within the litigation process. They are about the manner and means by which litigant rights are enforced. When those lawsuits are going to be filed. If we look at the underlying policies, What are the underlying policies of statutes of limitations? Why do we have statutes of limitations? Why put statutory limits on when a lawsuit can be filed? Alexa?
So that the defendant can be on notice that they might be served.
Okay. And what's the benefit of that?
They're prepared. They can be prepared.
Okay. Is that a procedural concern or is that a substantive concern? Is that about the judicial process and justly administer and remedy and redress?
Yeah, I would say.
Yeah. All right, what else? Debbie?
It also protects the memory of witnesses and who was involved in the lawsuit. So the more time passes, the more the witnesses can forget. So
how does that prompt statutes of limitations?
Because then they wouldn't have accurate recollection of what happened, so that could impact the validity of what they're saying during the
Okay, case. Which in turn impacts what?
I think if...
Don't think.
Or if the judicial process is just administered because you want accurate statements from witnesses...
Because that leads to what? To accurate what?
Results.
Yeah. Yeah, it's about accuracy and results. All right? Fresher evidence means the litigation is... It means the litigation is going to proceed better. More accurate evidence produces more accurate results. Is that a substantive or procedural concern, Gabby?
Procedural.
Okay, yeah, that's about the accuracy of the outcome. What else? Yeah.
Allowing the defendant to rest easy once the statute of limitations has expired.
What do you mean by rest easy?
Not having to be worried about being bailed into court.
And so that they can do what?
So that they can live their lives in the real world without worry of suit being brought.
And is that a substantive or procedural concern?
I would argue it's substantive.
You could argue lots of things. Is it substantive or procedural?
It's substantive.
All right, clearly that's substantive. That's the right to rest easy, the right to repose, and get on with your life. Stop worrying about being sued. Stop spending money on a lawyer from FIU who costs a lot of money. To be sued when you're not going to get attorney's fees because of the American rule, right? And get on with your life. Get on with your business knowing you're not going to be subject to a lawsuit. All right? So we've got this odd mixture. It is purely procedural in its application. But it does some procedural stuff. It does some substantive stuff. All right? 7A. So plaintiff files, so A files the lawsuit more than 2 years after the events at issue. So 7A, what is the defendant going to do in response? What is X going to do in response to this lawsuit? Lauren?
It's barred by a statute.
Well, how are they going to say that? They're just going to, you and Lucas are both standing on the table? File what? Lucas?
A 12B6 motion.
Arguing what?
That the suit is barred by statutes of limitations.
Because?
Because.
When was it filed?
It was filed 3 years after the incident.
Okay. And what's the limitations period?
2 years.
Because what are we applying?
Okay,
because, okay, again, because Florida law controls. All right, so that Florida 2-year statute of limitations controls. That's as far as we're going to go. Okay, we're going to stop there. We're going to leave you hanging. On 7, A, B, and C. All right. Go back and look at Burke if you haven't already done so. And think about Burke in the context of both the puzzle number 4 on the slap motion, but also number 1 on Wisconsin's law, and then the Wisconsin disclosure law, and then on number 8. So think about how Burke is going to apply to all of them. All right. Nice job. Remember Penelope Cannon and George Pring, and thanks for listening.
If we get a question on the final, that's like question 4, where we do the majority and minority analysis, are we expected to do that as well?
Well, it depends on what you're asked to do, right?
Right.
So if I ask you what the plaintiff's argument is, or what the defendant's argument is, then you're gonna make the best argument that they would make. Otherwise, make what you think is the best argument. I mean, if there's genuinely 2 ways to go, yeah, make what you think is the best argument.
Yeah.
So yesterday we were running through these, and we were wondering if when you go through the REA 27 and 2 analysis, you find that
start your analysis over.
In theory.
Well, I mean, you're going to start your analysis over because what should you never find? You should never find that a federal rule is invalid.
Okay.
So now what? No, but you found state. Which one were you doing?
No.
Oh, yeah, that would be invalid.
So then, okay, if the federal law is invalid, do you treat it as invalid?
Well, no. If the federal law is invalid, then you've got to go, well, shit, I just went where no man has gone before.
Okay.
Because I, or woman, because I just invalidated a federal rule of civil procedure. So okay, that's going to cause you to have.
Do you roll back into all of this?
Yeah, because you go, because why?
Relax.
And we're actually, you know what? Never mind. We'll talk about this tomorrow.
No.
We're going to talk about this tomorrow. So the question is, what do you do next and why? But why? But there is something to answer the question, rule 4.5, but okay, that's where we're going to come in. No, I'm not calling on any of the 3 of you now. In that case, there's no countervailing federal interest because it's federal site. It's theoretically possible there could be a federal interest in federal silence. There may be, I mean, it may be, the silence may be deliberate. The silence may serve a purpose. I don't think it does in number 4. But you could imagine, I'm trying to think of a case where there might be, yeah, I can't think of one off the top of my head. You could imagine where the federal silence is intended. But yeah, no, you're right. In the mind, you're absolutely right.
If there's federal silence, how do you then do the analysis under results different materially? Because when we were doing it together,
but look at 674 of Hannah, because it actually speaks to that very issue. Not right now. Look at page 674. Remember when on page 674 to 75 it identifies the 3 types of rules? Look at that paragraph because it's going to answer your question.
in terms of...
Just look at that, and it's going to answer your question about what, how you do this when there's federal silence.
I, for studying right now, I know what I think I know what I know, but yeah, that's the issue. So with Glannon and like the other resources that you give us, it's like a lot of questions for different topics. I was wondering if there's a specific...
What do you mean a lot of questions for different topics?
So like for like the LSAT, for example, when you try to figure out what you don't know, you just take all different questions and then see the patterns and the ones that you get wrong. Like, okay, this has to do with these specific kinds of issues. Is there like questions?
I mean, if you get a hold of E&E...
Okay.
And you kind of go through those problems, but go through them as if you were doing them as essays. Because
yes.
Remember, this is not going to be a multiple choice test.
Of course.
So, you know, that might help to give you some ideas of
okay.
questions.
Okay, that's
the essays you're going to, I mean, you've got 10 essays that you can look at.
Yeah.
One pretty much for just about every major topic that we've covered in class.
Yeah.
That's going to give you a pretty good sense of what the questions are. You don't know what the case is going to be, but it's going to give you a pretty good idea of what sorts of things you're going to be asked.
Okay.
And then the question is just how you apply that law, you know, that law that you know. You know what the analysis for discovery, you know, on a motion to compel is going to be. Now it's just a question of how you do that on the facts you have.
Okay. Thank you.
So for proposal number 5, how can X move under the same statute that we already said it doesn't apply? Like state law doesn't apply.
Well, because they're arguing for a different opinion. They're arguing for a different provision. The first one, in 4, they were making the special motion under state law. Here, they're just making a motion for attorney's fees. But it's a different provision. And so this is why you have to, when you're asking this question about what you've got to know precisely what the law is that you're talking about. Because they're different provisions. One is the special motion provision. One is the attorney's fees provision. And then number 7, 6, whatever the 6, was the cause of action provision. So there's 3, same law, 3 different provisions. Just like you can say, well, the federal rules of civil procedure control, you've got to identify some specific provisions that control.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yep.
I was confused by the code when you got to coexistence. Do you only get to that question?
It's
after?
Just, these are all ways of answer of asking the same question about whether federal law, whether an act of Congress otherwise requires or provides. So we can ask if federal law answers the question. We can ask if federal law is sufficiently broad to control. We can also ask whether there is a direct collision between federal law and state law.
So you don't ask them sequentially?
You can.
Because you got to coexistence after discussing whether
you can, but they're all getting at the same idea. They're all just different ways of framing that idea of whether an act of Congress otherwise requires or provides.
Or like the extent that it applies.
Yes.
Okay, I see. Thank you.
Rebecca, I won't be here tomorrow. I'm
going to
be at my church retreat.
Oh.
So I want to say bye.
Thank you so
much. I will see you next week. Class. I will see you next semester too. But next week, we have so much fun.
I'm glad. That is why this is my favorite topic.